Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Good afternoon. I'm Pat Morrison. The United States has a long history of supporting the government of Israel. In fact, for decades, Israel has been a cornerstone of American policy in the Mideast and a very emotional part of American policymaking here at home. A lot of American Jews have profound sentiments toward the state of Israel. In the wake of the Holocaust, the state of Israel has won the hearts of many, standing out as a beacon of democracy in the Mideast, according to many who talk about its allegiance and alliances with the United States. But has that relationship, in fact, done a disservice to the United States in some quarters, as it begins, as it launches its war on terror? And has the Israel lobby in the United States exerted an overweening influence, perhaps silencing voices of criticism, any sort of criticism toward Israel? The question is posed by the authors of The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, who join me here, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Nice to be here.
We'll also be taking your questions at 866-893-5722. You can text or email to ask@kpcc.org, but we'd love to hear from you, 866-893-5722. Mr. Walt, can you lay out briefly the premise of the book?
The basic premise of the book is that American policy in the Middle East, and in particular the unconditional support that the United States gives to Israel, is largely, not entirely, but largely due to the political activities of various pro-Israel groups, both Jewish and non-Jewish, in the United States. We argue that the United States has really an unprecedented relationship with Israel, giving it, you know, $3 billion plus a year in aid.
Unconditionally.
Pretty much unconditionally, sort of regardless of what Israeli policy is, and that one can't account for that by arguing that Israel is a vital strategic asset any longer, or by arguing that Israel's behavior is so exemplary that it deserves sort of special treatment from the United States. We don't think Israel acts worse than other states do. We just don't think it acts any better. And the explanation for this is the political activities of, again, Americans who want the United States to maintain unconditional support and use the American political system to do that. I would just make one final point is, of course, these activities are entirely legitimate. They're interest group politics, the way we see on lots of subjects like energy policy and gun control and other even ethnic groups. So we think it's a perfectly legitimate activity, but we think this has led to policies that are not good for the United States and also unintentionally harmful to Israel as well.
Mr. Mearsheimer, what do you think are the underlying reasons for your premise that that Israel does have such a powerful influence and, according to your book, not always a benevolent one for the United States?
Well, the key thing to understand, Pat, about the American political system is that interest group politics lies at the heart of the way we do business in this country. Interest groups really matter in American politics, whether you're talking about the National Rifle Association or the American Association of Retired People. And what happens here in the United States is that small numbers of people who are deeply dedicated to a particular issue can mobilize, and they carry weight in the political process that's far greater than their numbers. And, of course, you see this with the NRA. And we argue that if you look at the Israel lobby, what you see is you have a reasonably small number of Jews and non-Jews who are deeply committed to Israel. And they work very hard and very smartly to push American foreign policy, especially American policy in the Middle East, in a pro-Israel direction. And they're very effective at getting their way because, again, they're a well-organized and well-financed interest group, much like the National Rifle Association. Now, that brings us to the second question that you ask, which is, why do we tend to get policies that are not good for the United States, and as Steve pointed out, not good for Israel? The fact of the matter is that this interest group is interested in pushing a particular set of issues that they believe are good for Israel and good for the United States. But because it's almost impossible to challenge those views in the United States and for others to criticize the policies that they're pushing, We argue that what you tend to get here is a situation where you have bad policies. It would make much more sense if we had an open-ended debate about Israeli policy, say, in the occupied territories, or Israeli policy in the Lebanon War of 2006, and people were able to challenge what Israel is doing, and furthermore, to challenge the U.S.-Israeli relationship, to speak openly about what the pluses and minuses of that are. The end result of that debate would be a more positive outcome.
Mr. Walt, why is it impossible to speak to those things? If a bill, Mr. Mearsheimer mentioned the NRA or perhaps the AARP, a bill concerning those interests starts up through Congress and it ends up, you know, half and half. Everybody gets a little bit of something. You argue in this book that the Israel lobby pretty much gets what it wants. How does that happen?
Well, certainly in Congress, it gets almost everything it wants. You know, probably not absolutely everything it has ever pushed for, but overwhelming support in Congress and lots of influence in the executive branch. I think one of the reasons, of course, is that anyone who challenges the relationship, any politician who challenges the relationship, is likely to get targeted by a number of these groups. And one of the effects, of course, is that then campaign contributions will tend to flow towards that candidate's opponents or that incumbent's opponents. And there are a number of cases over the last 20 or 30 years where pro-Israel groups have targeted politicians they deemed insufficiently supportive of Israel and drove them out of office and were quite explicit about doing it. There's nothing hidden about this. There's no conspiracy here. This was electoral politics the way it often works in the United States. Of course, that puts other politicians on notice. And that's why, for example, you see every presidential candidate now, at a moment when we all know that American Middle East policy is deeply screwed up, every American presidential candidate is going over time trying to demonstrate just how devoted they are to one country, and that is, of course, to Israel. The second reason it's hard to talk about, of course, is that anybody who questions this gets smeared as an anti-Semite, gets accused of something as horrible as anti-Semitism. And a good example of that is what happened to Jimmy Carter last year when he published a book that was critical of Israeli policy in the occupied territories. He was accused of being a Jew hater. He was accused of being an anti-Semite by groups in the Israel lobby. One group accused him of being sympathetic to Nazism. And again, this is a man who, whatever you think of Jimmy Carter, is a very decent human being and did more to bring Israel peace than just about any American president ever has. And yet, because he got attacked, that's the kind of thing that stifles discussion and leads the United States to pursue policies that, again, are not in its interest and, we believe, not in Israel's long-term interest either.
Mr. Mearsheimer, very quickly, how does this hurt American policy, American efforts to fight the war on terror?
Well, one good example would be American support for Israeli policy in the occupied territories, more specifically American support for Israel's policy towards the Palestinians. Since the Israelis first captured the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in 1967, it has been the official policy of every American president to oppose settlement building in those occupied territories. And over the past decade, American presidents have been dedicated to building a viable Palestinian state as a way of creating peace in the Middle East. But what has happened here is that since 1967, it has been almost impossible for any president to put meaningful pressure on the Israelis to stop settlement building. So as a consequence, settlements have grown and grown and grown, making it more and more difficult to reach any sort of modus vivendi between the Palestinians and the Israelis, or to put it in slightly different terms, making it almost impossible to create a viable Palestinian state. This has been one of the principal causes. Let me underline that it's one of the principal causes, not the only causes, of our terrorism problem, the fact that we support the Israelis over the Palestinians. If the lobby was not operating to, in effect, push presidents not to put pressure on Israel over settlement building, not only would the United States be in better shape because our terrorism problem would be less, but also the Israelis would be better off because, as many Israelis and many American Jews understand, the whole settlement building enterprise in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip has been a strategic and moral disaster for Israel.
The co-authors of The Israel Lobby, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, will be speaking tonight at the Hammer Museum in Westwood beginning at 7 p.m. That's tonight at 7 p.m. For more information, you can go to kpcc.org and click on Pat Morrison. For details, you can also call us with your questions now, 866-893-5722. We are joined as well by Richard Cohen. He is a columnist at the Washington Post. He recently reviewed the book, the headline for which, as we know, we columnists are not responsible, is rationalizing Phasing Israel Out of Existence. Richard Cohen, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
You found yourself nodding in agreement for the first part of the book and then feeling irritated, you said, by the second part of the book. What was your response to the arguments put forward by Mr. Walt and Mr. Mearsheimer?
Well, let me back up a little bit and just say that, in general, I've been supportive of Mearsheimer and Walt. Originally, when they wrote a long piece in the London Review of Books and were attacked for it, my position has always been they're right. There is an Israel lobby. It is powerful. It is well-financed. It doesn't always do what I want it to do, and I sometimes disagree with it. I also thought they made a pretty good case. American foreign policy is too tethered to Israel. If you're just looking at it in terms of, you know, realism, very hard foreign policy decisions. What bothered me as I continued to read was that there seemed to be no sympathy towards Israel. And they're entitled not to be sympathetic toward Israel. You can treat Israel as Mexico or Denmark or any other country. You don't have to get emotionally involved with it. But I think in order to be persuasive to me, at least, you have to be appreciative of Israeli history and what shapes the country, what has shaped its foreign policy, what has shaped its outlook. And it's been a history of wars, of aggression, of, you know, going back now, Israel was founded in 1948, but the Israeli-Arab struggle, or whatever you want to call it, is way older than that. It goes back into the 19th century, the end of the 19th century. And there's been some horrendous incidents. There are numerous times when the Arab countries have refused to deal with Israel, recognize Israel, come to some sort of accommodation, invaded Israel time and time and time again. What I didn't get out of the book was an appreciation of, one, why Israel reacts the way it does at certain times, and, two, why the American Jewish community is in some sense so blindly sympathetic to Israel and gets so emotional for basically the same reasons. Having said that, and I said I found the book in the end to be too one-sided, too tough on Israel, left me cold. Having said that, I do think they have added something worthwhile to the debate. And as they know, I'm sickened by the charge that they're anti-Semites. I hate people who call anybody an anti-Semite simply because they disagree with them. And I think that, in many cases, they've been mistreated.
Mr. Cohen says that in all the criticism, you failed to make a case for Israel that would put the balance in here about, and some background explaining the nature of the relationship between the United States and Israel.
Well, I should say at the outset that we're very appreciative of a lot of the views that Richard has expressed in the past, the support he's given us and the fact that he clearly agrees with much of the substance of what we wrote. And I'm therefore a little reluctant to be at all critical or disagree too vehemently with what he just said. But I would make a couple of points. First of all, I do think in several places in the book we express our admiration for various features of Israeli society. We admire, for example, the fact that they have a wide open discourse in Israel and are sometimes very critical of their own politicians, are willing to hold their own politicians up to account in ways that I think we have not done as well in this country. Obviously, their scientific, technological, economic achievements, artistic achievements are deeply impressive and, again, a real contribution to the world. And I think we are also appreciative of many of the aspects of Israel's strategic situation over the years, although the story we tell, which is based very heavily on recent writings by Israeli historians, is a challenge to the sort of one-sided view of Israeli history that I think is widespread in the United States. There is a view, I think, that Israel has always been the sort of David surrounded by this mighty Arab Goliath that was trying to exterminate it. And again, Israeli historians themselves have largely punctured that set of myths. And our view here is that both sides of the Arab-Israeli conflict have done bad things in the past, that neither side really has the moral high ground here, but many Americans tend to view it in a rather one-sided fashion. I'll make one just final point, and then John may want to add something, but I am sympathetic to his view about sentiment, and we understand that many Americans have strong attachments to other countries, to include Israel. But ultimately, we both believe that when you let your heart govern your head in making foreign policy, you often end up following policies that aren't smart. And in this case, we believe that many of Israel's friends in the United States, and we would include ourselves as friendly to Israel, have supported policies that were harmful to Israel in part because they let their hearts get ahead of their heads on this one. And that's not a good way to make foreign policy.
When we come back, we're going to hear more from our authors, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, authors of The Israel Lobby, as well as from Richard Cohen with The Washington Post. John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt will be speaking at the Hammer Museum in Westwood tonight, beginning at 7 p.m. If you'd like more information about that event, go to kpcc.org and click on Pat Morrison. We'll also be taking your calls for our authors, 866-893-5722. Questions about the book, The Israel Lobby, when we come back.
Listeners are our most important source of funding. Here at 89.3 KPCC and 89.1 KUOR, it's member support that makes the programs you hear possible. Join our membership community by going to kpcc.org. Thanks.
Programming on KPCC comes from California State University Fullerton, home of the Center for Successful Aging, whose mission is the promotion of health, vitality, and well-being in the later years. The center's research and programming activities focus on senior fitness, balance, and mobility, and health promotion for older adults. Cal State Fullerton, celebrating 50 years of creating opportunities for future generations to discover, innovate, and achieve. More information at fullerton.edu.
This is 89.3 KPCC FM with IQ. Good afternoon. I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. The Federal Reserve cut a key interest rate for the first time in 4 years, starting with a half-point move to prevent a steep housing slump from triggering a recession. The action sparked a huge rally on Wall Street. The Fed announced today it was reducing its target for the federal funds rate, the interest banks charge each other, from 5.25% to 4.75%. 2 years ago, drivers in L.A. and Orange County spent on average almost 2 full work weeks a year in rush hour traffic. That's from a report by the Texas Traffic Institute. It found that, no surprise, L.A. and Orange County has reported the worst congestion in the country. David Schrank helped write the study. He says traffic costs drivers time and money.
The average traveler loses 38 hours a year, and also with that time, they waste 26 gallons of gas. If you put a price tag on that, that's over $700 per year per traveler that are lost just due to congestion.
The study says drivers in the Inland Empire spent an average of 49 hours a year in rush hour traffic, almost 10 times as much as a quarter century ago. It's 123.
I'm Pat Morrison. Perhaps no book on public policy in recent memory has stirred so much controversy as this one, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy by John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt, both of whom join me. And we are taking your calls about this book, 866-893-5722. We were just going to go to Mr. Mearsheimer for a quick response to the comment by Richard Cohen at the Washington Post. Mr. Mearsheimer?
Yeah, like Steve, I appreciate very much Mr. Cohen's positive approach to dealing with this and ignoring the name calling and agreeing with us on all sorts of points. But just three very quick points. One is that we fully understand the history of anti-Semitism. And second, we therefore think it is a wonderful thing, and I'm not exaggerating here, and get the fact that there is a Jewish state. We're not anti-Zionists. And my final point is that we make very clear in the book and in all our public appearances that we believe that if Israel's survival were threatened, the United States should come to its aid. Our basic point, however, is that the United States should treat Israel as a normal country. We should end this special relationship, and that it would be good for not only the United States, but good for Israel.
I'll ask you in a little bit about what sort of specific policy changes you would endorse. First, we're going to hear from Jonathan, who's calling from Laurel Canyon. Jonathan, thank you.
Yes, I'd like to say, first of all, that this is a highly unusual book, one written by academicians, because there's no original academic research in it. So you get a strong impression that, despite all the protestations that we've heard in the program, that these are people with a certain agenda, and I wouldn't define it at this moment, and who are covering this in a veneer of academic research, although, as I say, there's no original research. The second point is that the book contains very many distortions. your program is too short to enumerate them, but I would just refer to the opening statement of the gentleman being interviewed, the professor, who said that Israel is no better than any other state. Well, would he compare Israel with Egypt, which is one of the largest recipients of American aid? Isn't he up in arms about the amount of aid that Egypt receives, given that it's a dictatorship, that there's no rule of law? Is he mentioning Egypt and Israel in the same breath?
All right, Jonathan, let's put those questions to Mr. Mearsheimer.
Yeah, let me deal with a couple of those points. First of all, we did do a great deal of research. The book has over 100 pages of endnotes, and I'm sad to say that I think you need a magnifying glass to read them because they're so small. This is an easily readable book, but nevertheless, it represents academic scholarship for sure. The question of whether or not we have an agenda, I think that implies that we have an agenda to sort of get Israel. That's not what we're all about. We have an agenda in the sense that we're interested in examining why U.S. Middle East policy is in trouble today and how America's unconditional support of Israel affects our situation in the Middle East. And the basic argument we're making, as Steve spelled out, is that our unconditional aid for Israel has helped get us into trouble in the Middle East. If you want to call that an agenda, fine. With regard to Egyptian aid, the fact is that Israel and Egypt get aid for related reasons. The reason we give Egypt so much aid is because Egypt has reached a peace agreement with the Israelis. And in effect, that's bribe money to Egypt. And the third largest recipient of American foreign aid is Jordan. And the reason that Jordan gets so much foreign aid from the United States is because it too reached a peace agreement with Israel. So that Egyptian and Jordanian aid is inextricably bound up with American support for Israel.
What about the concern that Jonathan expressed that in supporting Egypt, we're supporting a dictatorship?
Well, the United States supports dictatorships when we think it's in our interest to do so. And providing aid to Egypt and Jordan as part of the peace agreements with Israel was seen as something very much in the American interest. We've provided help to other dictatorships and provided help to other democracies. And we may not like certain aspects of their policies, but we've decided, I think correctly in this case, that backing those countries as we have and encouraging them to remain at peace with Israel is a good thing for us and good for Israel as well.
Jonathan, thank you for your call. We are taking your calls on this at 866-893-5722. Robert is calling from Ventura. Robert, thank you for your call. Robert, go ahead. Turn down your radio, please.
Yes, I just did. Thank you.
I
got one hand on the phone and the other one on the steering.
Understood. Wheel. Go ahead.
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are. Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. My comment was I just completed the book by Shlomo Ben Ami, which I suspect the authors have heard, in which he talks about the fact that as far back as the 1930s and early 40s, it was part of the, I think it's called Eretz Israel plan for Israel to ultimately occupy all of Palestine. I should add here that I am a supporter of Israel, but I'm concerned about the fact that so little attention is paid in this country to the effects of the West Bank and the way in which it ultimately is going to have a dominant effect on our foreign policy. I'd just love to hear some comments about Mr. Banami's book, if either of your authors are acquainted with his work.
Okay.
He was a foreign minister under Prime Minister Barak, as you know.
Right. Thank you. Stephen Wald?
Yeah, the book he's referring to is called Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, Shlomo Ben-Ami, the former Israeli foreign minister. It's an excellent book. It's quite revealing about aspects of Israeli history. And importantly, Ben-Ami also makes the very important point that the two presidents in the United States who did the most for Arab-Israeli peace, the two presidents were Jimmy Carter and the first President Bush. And Ben-Ami points out that both of these people did the most for Arab-Israeli peace, the most to benefit Israel, because they were not as sensitive to the influence of pro-Israeli forces in the United States. They took a more independent course. And it's not me saying that. This is the former foreign minister of Israel saying this. It's a very fine book. I recommend it.
Pat, can I jump in here?
Yes, please.
I
this is Richard Cohen, our guest, yes?
Right.
Okay.
I'm sitting at my desk with several copies, two copies of the book, heavily underlined, and I just came across something that it's indicative of what bothered me, and it's a line that goes, in other words, the United States should support Israel's continued existence just as it supports the existence of France, Thailand, or Mexico, and Washington should be prepared to intervene if Israel's survival will ever threaten. Well, the difference is, I don't know anybody in recent times who's made a suggestion that Mexico should be blown off the map, or Thailand or France. But this is the experience for Israel. Recently the president of Iran did that. These are not, Israel is just not another country. I mean, you cannot claim it is another country. You may want it to be another country, but its situation is much too precarious and has been much too precarious for it to be treated like it's just another country. And there is, previous to that, the authors say, citing the Iranian nuclear threat, they just dismiss it. They say, well, it's just not going to happen. And I happen to agree with them. I don't think it's going to happen either. But it would be the height of folly for any Jew born in the 20th century to dismiss the threat to kill Jews. I mean, it has happened, and it is part of the Jewish experience, it's part of the Israeli experience. You just can't dismiss it. So it is that kind of cold, analytical look at foreign policy that turned me off when I got into the book. Well, I say over and over again, I generally support the thesis.
Maybe Mr. Mearsheimer, Mr. Cohen's point is that there's a false equivalency here and that Jews are not paranoid. They really do have someone out to get them.
Well, there's a couple points to be made here. First of all, we agree that Israel is not in the same situation today that Mexico is in or even France is in. But we did make the point loudly and clearly in the book that if Israel's survival was threatened, that the United States should come to its rescue. And we did not call for abandoning Israel. We simply called for ending the special relationship and treating it like a normal country. Now, Mr. Cohen says that it's not a normal country, that its situation is too precarious to use that label. I don't think its situation is that precarious at all. I don't think its situation has ever been that precarious. The whole David and Goliath myth has been turned on its head. The Israelis won wars in 1948, 1956, 1967, and 1973. And it wasn't because of some miracle from God. It was because they had the most formidable military forces in the region. And those forces have only grown more powerful with time. They have a very powerful ally in the United States. They have hundreds of nuclear weapons. They've reached a peace agreement with Jordan and with Egypt. And they almost had a peace agreement with Syria in 2000. And according to President Clinton, it was the Israelis, not the Syrians, who walked away. The Saudis are now pushing a peace initiative that's designed to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I don't think that Israel is in a precarious position today, and I don't think it has been since 1948 when it's created. And I think that's a good thing. I do agree that it would not be good for Israel if Iran had nuclear weapons, but it would not be the end of the world because Israel has a nuclear deterrent of its own, and if Iran were to threaten to use nuclear weapons, Israel could threaten to incinerate Iran in retaliation. So I think that is a bit of a problem, and that's one the United States should work to prevent from happening, but I don't think it's the end of the world. Finally, I would point out, Mr. Cohen, I do believe it would be in Israel's best interest if its supporters tended to be more cold and calculating these days and less emotional. I think that because many of Israel's defenders are so emotional about this subject, they make it almost impossible for people like you and for people like us to have an open discourse about the whole subject of Israeli policy and the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And I'm a firm believer, and I would assume that you are, that any time you shut down rational discourse about state behavior, whether it's the United States or Israel, you're asking for real trouble because states, whether it's Israel or the United States, sometimes do foolish things. And the best way to prevent that from happening or correct course if you do something foolish is to have an open debate. And again, it's very hard to have an open debate in the United States, as I think you know, because this is such an emotional issue. It should be less emotional.
Richard Cohen, is it possible to extricate that emotionality? And as according to Mr. Mearsheimer, the United States has certainly done a great deal to put Israel in the position of strength that it has today. How much more needs to be done?
Well, I agree that this emotionality is not necessarily a good thing, and I've been on the receiving end of it when I've been critical of Israel policies from time to time. I'm always asked why American Jews are so critical of me when I'm critical of Israel, when I write is commonplace in Israel itself. In fact, I was at a meeting last night where people were talking about a new poll, foreign policy poll, and it turns out that 42% of Israelis think that America is too favorable to Israel. So I know where these Israelis are politically. But I think there's a difference between emotion and values, and that an appreciation of values, of what another, the values that another country has that are similar to your own or ones you admire, doesn't necessarily fall into the area of emotion, that emotionality. It's a respect for the country and who it is and what its history has been. And in my column, I made the comparison to Britain, which, you know, made people nuts. But, I mean, I feel emotional about England. I don't know why I do. I mean, you know, they you play English songs.
It isn't the food.
You know what? Right. It's Churchill, you know, and I get weepy, and I get that way about France a little bit, too, even though the recent history of it has not been a good one as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, you just say, these are our pals, these are our friends, and we're in this fight together because we know what our values are, and we know we've been, you know, through this war together and that war together. And this is not the same as emotion. This is the same as you. This is a reflection of your own values and where you stand. And my feeling is, down deep, even though I have a lot of differences with this Israeli government or that Israeli government, and I think the West Bank settlements are abhorrent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Israel is a country that whose values I respect and I admire. And I think I would feel this way even if I wasn't an American Jew. But being an American Jew, it's, you know, I am what I am, and this is how I feel.
We have a call from Matt in downtown. Matt, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. What I was wondering is, I sort of want to challenge the basic assumption that America, as a multicultural, multireligious country, should be backing a state which is really designed to support just one religion. You know, I have no problem if the Jewish people wish to have their own state, but what interest does a democracy that supports many cultures and many religions have in the survivor of Israel?
Mr. Walt, maybe you can address that.
Well, John and I mean, the caller has raised a fascinating question, and it does convey some of the ways in which there are differences between American democracy, which is a multi-ethnic, liberal democracy, melting pot society, and Israeli democracy, which was explicitly founded as the Jewish state. But John and I don't actually question Israel's right to exist or its legitimacy as a Jewish state. We think the long history of anti-Semitism in the Christian West provides an ample justification for the Jews having their own state the same way other peoples have their own state. So we fully support Israel's right to exist on a moral basis as well as when it is acting in ways that we think are consistent with broader American foreign policy interests. Again, we ultimately don't think the reason that the United States should support country A or country B is simply because its values are identical to us. We should support country A and country B when it's doing things that are consistent with American interests and with American values, and we should not support actions that those countries might take that aren't consistent with American interests and American values. So to just return briefly to what Mr. Cohen was saying a moment ago, we can share lots of values with Israel, and we can feel that they have some similarities with us in certain political terms, but we ought to also be able to oppose those aspects of Israeli policy, like the settlements in the West Bank, that are not consistent with U.S. interests and not consistent with American democratic values. And it would be nice if politicians in the United States, say in Congress, could occasionally stand up and say that they thought the settlements were a bad idea too. Of course, you almost never hear that because it's politically risky to do it.
Well, let me ask Mr. Cohen if you see any change in the weather on Capitol Hill or in Washington vis-a-vis U.S. policy and Israel, considering the protracted war on terrorism.
No. You know, there's some murmurings that among liberal groups and American Jewish community that this has to change, but I'm old enough to have seen this come and go a number of times. I agree with the authors that there ought to be more discussion. I agree that there are aspects to Israeli policy that the United States ought to challenge. I've sat in the office of the Secretary of State, various Secretary of States, who have told me that they were going to, you know, confront the Israelis. It almost never happens. Most American, you know, there is a lobby. There are people who passionately care about Israel. Everybody in politics knows you get defeated by people who hate you. You know, not you don't necessarily win because you have support. What you have to do in politics is eliminate the people who are going to vote against you. And this is an issue in which a lot of people will cast a vote yes or no, yay or nay, based upon Israel, just as the NRA is one or abortion is one. There are issues that have that kind of strength. And I don't see Capitol Hill, I don't see that changing any in the near future when it comes to Israel.
Mr. Mearsheimer, you have a question for Richard Cohen.
Mr. Cohen, I'd like to ask you a question. Don't you think it would have been much better for Israel if the United States had used its considerable leverage over the past 3 or 4 decades to prevent the building of settlements and in the summer of 2006 to discourage the Israelis from executing the war that they launched against Lebanon after the kidnappings, and then we had tried to shut down that war once it started? Don't you think that it would have been better for Israel, too, if we were a bit more hard-nosed with the Israelis? Not in a mean way, but in a smart way?
The answer to the first question is yes. I do think. I've written numerous times that the West Bank settlements are no good for Israel, no good for world peace, a poke in the eye to the Arab world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I agree with you on that. The Lebanon War, I find that, I was appalled after a while at what was happening, but I don't know, and I'm very sympathetic to Israel on that score, on what you do when your soldiers are kidnapped and when you get cross-border shelling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Israel is supposed to respond in a proportionate way, but Israel can't afford to be to respond in a proportionate way. It's a small country with a limited population. It's got to hit back hard, and that's what it did. Now, I think it went a little bit too far this time and over the top, and it was a badly, badly managed war. I don't mean just in terms of the way it came out, but it was as incompetently managed a war as the one we launched in Iraq. There must be something in the air.
But gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up with that. We have you both appearing at the Hammer Museum tonight to speak about your book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, on the bestseller list high up on Amazon.com. John Mearsheimer is with the University of Chicago. Stephen Walt is with Harvard School of Government or Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Thank you both so very much for joining us.
Very nice of talking to you.
Thank you.
And thanks to Richard Cohen as well, columnist at the Washington Post, who recently reviewed the book. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Pat.
And we've been hearing for 20 years about conservative politics in America, so much so it seemed that the conservative Christian voting bloc was a permanent fixture on the American landscape, so much so it even made its way into television. Here is a bit from West Wing, where our upcoming guest, Alan Alda, plays a California Republican senator complaining about the influence of the conservative right.
The United States Senate gets to advise and consent on judges, not the clergy. If his gang wants to have a say in picking judges, tell him to run for the Senate.
Alan Alda will be talking not so much about politics, but his new book in the second hour. But coming up, we're talking about the values debate last night and why the leading candidates in the Republican run for the presidency did not show up at this all-important debate, at least something that would have been all-important when social conservatives dominated American foreign policy. That's coming up next.
Programming on KPCC is supported by Providence St. Joseph, which uses state-of-the-art robotic technology to perform minimally invasive surgeries. Robotic technology is designed to help patients achieve faster recoveries with less pain and scarring. Providence St. Joseph and Providence Holy Cross Medical Centers, leading the surgical revolution toward better results for patients. For more information, you can call 1-888-HEALING.
This is 89.3 KPCC, online at kpcc.org. Good afternoon. I'm Hetty Lynn Hurdies. A man who claims O.J. Simpson barged into his hotel room and stole sports memorabilia is in critical condition after suffering a heart attack. 53-year-old Bruce Fromong is in intensive care at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Fromong is a dealer in sports memorabilia. He claims Simpson and others stole sports items from him and another dealer in a Vegas hotel room last week. Simpson was arrested on Sunday. Firefighters now have a line around more than half of the wildfire burning near Big Bear Lake, but several hundred people in and near Fawnskin on the north end of the lake are still evacuated. The fire has burned more than 14,000 acres since it began Friday. Robin Prince is a spokeswoman for the U.S. Forest Service.
We're expecting the winds to pick up in the afternoon. Predictions are for 5 to 10 mile an hour winds.
This would be lighter than yesterday. Actress Shirley Jones and her husband, Marty Ingalls, were among those who fled their homes. The couple owns a 17-acre estate in Fawnskin. In Burbank right now, the 5 North is congested from Western to Burbank Boulevard. That's because of a Caltrans sweeper. It's 1:45.
Programming is supported by Kaiser Permanente, who believe that every step counts. Walking can be a good form of exercise for many people with arthritis. It burns calories, builds stronger bones, and strengthens the muscles. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Eight or 12 years ago, it wouldn't have happened, but it just did. The debate called the Values Voters Presidential Debate last night failed to attract the top four in the top tier of candidates running for the Republican nomination for President of the United States. Rudy Giuliani, who is trying to court the conservative vote, Mitt Romney, who claims it is his own, as well as Arizona Senator John McCain and former Senator Fred Thompson, all four missed the debate, which drew second tier candidates to be questioned in Florida by leading conservative social organizations. And the moderator of the debate, Joseph Farah, who is the editor of an online conservative website, had warned them that those who did not show up would be paying the price at the polls. The Reverend James Dobson, who heads Focus on the Family and other conservative organizations in Florida or in Colorado, has said that he will not support Rudy Giuliani. No way, no how. And if he doesn't support an also-ran, he may sit out this presidential election for the first time ever. The question is whether social conservatives are losing their clout in Republican politics and on the political landscape in this country. Chris Saliza is a Washington Post political reporter and author of The Fix. It's a political blog on WashingtonPost.com. Mr. Saliza, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What did the no-shows in last night's debate tell us about the American political landscape? Or was it all about, as they always say, scheduling?
Well, you know, I think we've seen more demands on these candidates' schedules than any time before. I've covered these elections in the past, and the sheer number of debates and candidate forums and get-togethers is really overwhelming. You could, as a candidate, simply go from one debate to forum to debate to forum and not spend any time actually meeting voters who live in these early primary states that you need to win the nomination. I think that you have to be careful in reading too much into it. I do think in what I've covered in this election so far, I do think several of the candidates, Mitt Romney would be in that group, Fred Thompson would be in that group, John McCain would be in that group, have all tried to court social conservative voters each in their own way. Even Rudy Giuliani has, even though he doesn't have, he has obvious problems when it comes to courting that group. I think they are less monolithic than many people thought they were in the 1990s. I always thought that was a little bit of a misnomer, that, you know, this idea that the Christian conservative movement was one simple block that was all motivated by one simple issue, whether it's abortion or gay rights. I always thought was slightly simplistic. I think it is more of a complex movement now, and therefore more difficult to sort of predict how or how they won't vote or act in an election.
Let me break in for a moment to say that the Associated Press is reporting that the judge in Phil Spector's second-degree murder trial says that jurors have told him they believe they are at an impasse. We will have more information about this, of course, from KPCC News at the top of the hour. But the judge in Phil Spector's second-degree murder trial says jurors have told him that they believe they are at an impasse in the charges against the former music producer. Mr. Saliza, sorry to interrupt you with that news. We have in candidates like Mitt Romney a guy who is being accused of flip-flopping on issues of abortion, on issues of gay rights. And one of the websites that is devoted to scrutinizing candidates and gay issues put up a copy of a gay pride flyer, a Mitt Romney gay pride flyer from Massachusetts some years back. Rudy Giuliani doesn't play well with the gun lobby or the anti-abortion lobby. How do they parse their positions in this to make sure that they attend to this very high propensity voting block but don't cave into them?
Well, you know, I think both Giuliani and Romney benefit from the fact that they're not running against George W. Bush in 1999 and 2000. There isn't an obvious candidate that social conservatives have unified behind, and that helps people like Romney and Giuliani, who have a mixed, at best, record on some of these issues. You know, races are not, the thing I always remind myself about elections is they're not conducted in a vacuum. It's not best generic social conservative Republican candidate versus Rudy Giuliani. It's, you know, Mitt Romney, Fred Thompson, and Rudy Giuliani. So I think the fact that none of the top-tier candidates has a what many people would describe as a pure record when it comes to abortion issues, when it comes to gay rights issues, I think because of that, there's more of a willingness to give a Romney or a Giuliani something of a pass. Now, again, I don't think there is a group of social conservative voters who simply will not vote for Rudy Giuliani because of his record as the mayor of New York City.
As we heard James Dobson talk about.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's no question there's a strain within the social conservative movement, the Republican Party, that says if we nominate someone like Rudy Giuliani, what fundamentally does it mean to be a Republican? There are others, however, that say, well, you have to look at him in comparison to the other candidates in the field, none of whom have, in what I'm talking about the top tier here, none of them have an absolutely pure record. And look at the bigger picture, and the bigger picture for a lot of Republicans these days is three words: Hillary Rodham Clinton. And the one thing that no Republican wants is another 8 years of a Clinton administration. And so a lot of people think Giuliani might be the best chance to keep that from happening. So they may be swallowing some of their doubts and adopting a little bit more of a practical attitude this cycle, than more so than we've seen in past elections.
Ralph Reed is the former president of the Christian Coalition. He is also the president of Century Strategies. It's a public affairs and public relations firm. Mr. Reed, thank you for joining us.
You bet. Good to be with you.
We heard about what happened at the values debate last night, where the leading candidates did not show up. What do you think this says about the Christian conservative voting bloc and about the presidential field on the Republican side?
Well, I don't know that that specific event, in terms of the attendance at the event, says as much as the broader reality, which is really twofold. Number one, grassroots social conservatives in the Republican Party do not, at least in the top-tier candidates, have the kind of champion that they found in, say, Ronald Reagan in 1980 or George W. Bush in 2000. Keep in mind that George W. Bush had been the governor of Texas. He had signed the most sweeping pro-life legislation that had ever passed in Texas. He was a tax cutter. He personally professed to a Christian faith himself. He had a tremendous amount of comfort with these voters, knew how to communicate with them, had done so obviously in Texas, where they had played a critical role in the party there. I think because you have this time candidates who, for various reasons, are going to have difficulty meeting that bar, I think it's created a degree of confusion for social conservatives. This is the first time we haven't had a front runner for the Republican nomination since Barry Goldwater was nominated in 1964. And it's the first time that you've had consistently, now into the ninth month, having a self-described pro-choice candidate, namely Rudy Giuliani, leading the nomination. That's the first reality. I think the second reality, though, which is more encouraging for social conservatives, is that in varying ways, all of those candidates are trying to make appeals to that constituency. They recognize the importance of it, whether it's Rudy Giuliani saying, I'm going to appoint strict constructionist judges, and saying he supports the partial birth abortion ban, or Mitt Romney, who changed his position from pro-choice to pro-life. I personally believe authentically. So they're coming in that direction. This is a motion picture. It's not a still photograph. And keep in mind, we're still a long way from having a nominee, so we need to let it play out.
Is it possible, Mr. Reed, that conservative, social conservative voters are going to have to set their priorities? They'll say, okay, I can vote for him even though, for example, he is pro-choice but anti-gay marriage. They have to pick their priorities.
I think what they're going to have to remember is that an 80% friend is not a 20% enemy, and that in politics you can't make the perfect the enemy of the good. If you end up with a Republican nominee who says, look, you may not agree with me on some issues, but I'm in support of defining marriage as between a man and a woman. I'm going to do no harm on abortion, and if I get a common sense restriction, I'll favor it. I'm going to appoint judges who are strict constructionists, who share my conservative judicial philosophy, and these other issues, and they're strong supporters of Israel and believe in lower taxes and limited government. You have to remember that when we get past this intramural process, and it's that nominee standing on a stage in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and on the other side is going to be Hillary Clinton, I think you're going to have unity.
Chris Cillizza with The Washington Post. This is not something we're accustomed to hearing from social conservatives, a more pragmatic approach. Do you think that it's going to take hold, or is it only Hillary Clinton that's forcing this?
Well, I think Ralph is right when he highlights Senator Clinton. As I mentioned before, I think Senator Clinton may be the one thing that can unite a relatively fractious Republican Party at the moment. There is no question. It's interesting, when you talk to Democrats sort of in the chattering class here in Washington and ask them who they think the nominee is going to be, most say Hillary Clinton, but some fair portion say Barack Obama, and some say John Edwards. If you talk to Republicans, there is almost total agreement that Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee. Whether that's wishful thinking or just their belief in the Clinton strength as a sort of to win that primary. So I do think that part of the calculation that Republicans will make is exactly what Ralph is talking about, that it's a forced pragmatism of sorts, is that maybe Rudy Giuliani winds up being the nominee because he is the candidate who can beat Senator Clinton and is a better position, certainly, than she is on the issues that are near and dear to them. Certainly not as well positioned as they would like a candidate to be, but much better in their mind than a Hillary Clinton as an option. So I do think that the specter of Senator Clinton as a nominee has a powerful, unifying and pragmatic effect on the Republican field and in the mind of the Republican primary voter.
Chris Cillizza, very quickly, is this going to affect not so much turnout, but donations as well? A lot of money from social conservatives who might now be, they'll go ahead and vote, but they might be lukewarm about doing anything else.
Well, I think, and Ralph may know better than I do, but I still think the real benefit of social conservative voters is their willingness, their dedication to a candidate or a cause, and their willingness to turn out. Remember, the Iowa caucuses, the New Hampshire primary, these are very low turnout affairs, and so if you can convince a group of loyal, dedicated, impassioned voters to come out and vote for you, it can make a difference. 1,000 or 2,000 voters really can make a difference. So I think less important is the money factor. All these candidates are frankly going to have plenty of money to do what they need to do in these early states. I think it's finding, identifying, and turning out folks who are supportive of your message, whether it's 50 degrees or 5 degrees.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I hope we'll be able to call on your expertise as this endless campaign keeps going. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Chris Cillizza is a Washington Post reporter and author of The Fix, the political blog on WashingtonPost.com. Ralph Reed was the director of the Christian Coalition. He's now the president of Century Strategies. It's a public relations and public affairs group. Gentlemen, thank you again very much for joining us. Coming up after the news, Alan Alda talks about his new book, Things I Overheard While Talking to Myself, Some Life Lessons and Life Experiences from the Author and Actor. That's after some news. You're listening to 89.3 KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Sony Pictures Classics. Present